everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. It's another exciting podcast today that I'm looking forward to, and I hope you enjoy it as well. I have with me Sunny Sattva, the founder of the Vegan African Fund. Have you heard about it? VAF, Vegan African Fund. It's quite fascinating. I think we're going to learn not only a lot about the organization, but a lot about the world today and the economy and how business operates, which I think is above a lot of people's heads these days. So Sunny, thank you for joining me.
Absolutely, Karen. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here with you and to be here with your listeners to share our mission and really share how important it is to be investing in the plant-based and sustainable future of Africa, which is my passion.
I saw an article about you and I saw sort of your photo and a quick little video on your website. I had a connection. So I'm hoping we have a connection during this hour because I was feeling a lot of wonderful energy from you. And a number of things I wanted to highlight even before we get into your business. I want to talk about you and where you came from and how you got to where you are today. So let's just start there. You're originally from Las Vegas?
I grew up in Las Vegas. Yes, I'm actually originally from Virginia. Las Vegas has been home since I was a little child. It's where my parents are now. And I didn't grow up in a casino on the strip. There are houses in Vegas for all of you guys who haven't been. And surprisingly, you know, normal American life growing up, but raised in a very multicultural family. We're Black, white, and Indian. And, you know, doing DNA tests when I was in my adult years showed me that that is actually coming from ancestry from over 24 countries. And really seeing those results was the first kind of internal push for me to say, I have ancestors from 13 different African countries. I have to connect with them. I have to connect with this space. And joining some diaspora, you know, groups in the States really led me to feel empowered to make my way. You know, it's almost like a spiritual journey for me initially, which was when I traveled back to Kenya in 2020. And then from there realized that there is no better place in the world to be investing than in Africa.
Wow. Who knew that, everybody? Take notes. Well, Las Vegas is a place that has been through a tremendous transition over the last 30 years or so.
Oh my gosh, I know. Talk about it.
Yeah.
And it felt like living on the edge of the desert. And now it's, you know, all as far as you can see is development. And I think that it's definitely something that instilled in me very early a mentality of climate activism, where I grew up going to the Hoover Dam and Lake Mead and visually seeing year by year the water levels in this, you know, lake going down. You can see the lines on the ridges and the mountains where the Colorado River used to rise compared to where it is now. And so from very early on, I found myself as a climate activist, as a, you know, zero waste kind of activist. And that transitioned to me eventually going vegan back in 2015. So recently celebrated 6 years of living a plant-based lifestyle, vegan lifestyle. Yes, and it feels so good.
Everybody, give her a round of applause. Yay.
Thank you, Karen. And especially in January, this month is internationally recognized as the month of Veganuary, where millions of people around the world have signed up to try a plant-based diet for the month of January and hopefully beyond, to better our health, to reduce our environmental impact, and of course, reduce the amount of suffering in the world. And that is such an inspiration for me to keep going every single day, is realizing by making a conscious choice to go against how I was raised, which was eating animal products and which was eating, you know, a standard Western diet, to shift away from that and towards eating plant-based, I feel that the decisions I make on my plate are truly leading to the world I want to see, which is one of equity and abundance, and one where, you know, the climate change crisis is no longer a crisis. And that's what I kind of hope to see, is mobilization around the world of practices that can reduce climate change. And adopting a plant-based diet has been shown by the United Nations IPCC as the most impactful action an individual can take to fight climate change. So this is something that I hope, you know, people consider, even if it's not full time. It does, you know, there's this kind of saying we have in the vegan community that the world would be better with 1 billion imperfect vegans than 1 million perfect ones. Meaning if you are eating plant-based 50 or 70 or 90% of the time, that's still having such a huge positive impact.
It just still amazes me. I've been vegan for 33 years and vegetarian for longer. And I mean, I've heard this for decades, and it excites me when I hear it coming back and hearing more people talking about it. But still, it's taking a long time to get this very simple message out to this planet, our home.
Absolutely.
Now, Las Vegas is a very vegan-friendly place.
Yes, it's so nice. I'm actually back here right now after a little over a year in East Africa. And even in just this year, I think that, you know, the coronavirus pandemic has really led a lot of people to being more conscious about how they're consuming for their own personal health, especially. And so now there's, you know, dozens, maybe 30 or 40 completely vegan restaurants across the Las Vegas Valley. Super awesome place to go if you are vegan, even if it's not vegan restaurants. Everywhere has options. And it's definitely, I think, a really wonderful reflection of where the US as a whole is heading. You know, when we look at other Western countries, like in the UK right now, it's something like over 10% of people identify as vegan, and over 30% of people approve of like moving towards a plant-based diet. So that for me is kind of the best or the most progressive example of a nation moving towards plant-based. But I have this little joke that I always make. I grew up in Las Vegas and people call themselves Las Vegans. It's Las Vegans. So I'm like, I'm also a creative writer. I'm like working on this, like, I don't know, this story plot line where basically Las Vegas gets a sports team and it's called the Vegans. So manifesting that out there.
I used to say that I was from the planet Vega, you know, a vegan, because I always feel like an alien.
And I think for you, it must feel more and more like the rest of your civilization has landed on Earth now, because 33 years ago, it really must have felt like you were kind of one in a million.
Yeah. And the good thing is, back then I was considered a flake, weird, just all kinds of strange things. And now I'm looked up to with respect, and people come to me, especially at my age, because I'm older now, and most of my friends, a lot of my friends are older and they have health conditions, and they're making the connection that the diet can make a difference. So I'm hearing from more of them in a different way.
That's awesome. Wow. I'm happy for you. Okay.
Yeah. Well, so again, like I mentioned before, I've got so many things that I want to say all at once, can't do it. But you mentioned realizing that you come from so many different cultures in Africa, so many different countries. And it never really interested me to my background, but I learned a few years ago, and I was raised Jewish, I'm not religious. I always like to make that disclaimer, but I learned that there's a certain amount of Spanish in my background. I was, I'm like Eastern European, German, Polish, Russian, that kind of thing. But there's a splash of Spanish. And recently Spain passed a law that where they were going to offer dual citizenship to people that could prove their Sephardic background based on the Jews that were banned from Spain in 1492.
Oh, whoa.
I don't know, a light went on. And I realized that there's a part of me that comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt this need to kind of reach backwards to my ancestors in 1492, who were refugees, who had to leave their country.
Absolutely.
And so I've been going through this process of the dual citizenship thing. It's complicated.
Oh, congratulations.
Spain is a problem because they made this law in 2015 and they kind of changed it last year. And some are saying it's not really legal what they did. They made it more complicated just when I was about to finish my application. So now I'm working on Portugal because Portugal did the same thing as Spain. It's a long story. 1492 was not a good year for humanity.
No, but I think it really is. And I think for all Americans, we have to come back and remember this, that we're all global citizens, like pretty much across the board. We are global citizens, whether however many lines of ancestry removed that is from now. And it really is an amazing thing to connect with your roots and to, you know, feel that ancestral wisdom and connection. I think that as much as we have to live in the present and be looking towards the future, there's certainly something to me that's really inspiring and rewarding about connecting to those roots.
Yeah, especially if you realize why people moved across the globe. Many reasons are not nice or good or kind. Some people,
my ancestors from the African continent were largely enslaved people who came to the US, you know, unwillingly, but my American past or my American lineage has been traced by my aunt back to the 1700s and earlier. So, you know, it's almost, you know, a struggle to look at however many 10 generations that is and still feel like that connection to somewhere you are so far removed, which is why I'm 100% in support of birthright trips in whatever way that means for you in whatever country, whatever region. And one thing that I found, you know, going to Kenya and connecting with the community and explaining my heritage and roots there was a lot of like incredible just acceptance and openness and excited, you know, vibration from people who are really excited, you know, comparing me to Obama a few too many times in a very fun way.
Of course. Yeah. Lovely. So the next thing before we get to the big topic today, which is the Vegan African Fund, I had read in an interview that you had a partner who had cancer and that led you to the vegan diet.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that a little bit. Also, 15 years ago, I had advanced ovarian cancer. I should be dead. Now, I was already vegan, but what I learned was I needed to bring it up a few notches and really focus on my healing. And that's a whole nother story. But I appreciate people who take control of their lives and see something that happens and says, you know, this situation does not have to have a bad ending, or I can use it and do good from it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my partner at the time, we were, you know, we thought we were healthy. We were working out a lot. We were eating what we thought was a high protein, healthy diet, which was really a lot of animal products. And he got this sickness that we weren't sure what it was for months. And when it was finally diagnosed, it was actually a tumor in his spinal cord, which is a very rare kind of cancer, very scary, because the doctors, when they diagnosed the tumor, basically told him, you've got 3 to 6 months to live. Like, it was basically a death sentence. And that was something that we weren't going to take. That was something that we decided we had to take control of. And so we came across several different books. We came across the China study, which was definitely a really big inspiration. And we also talked to several kind of holistic healthcare practitioners and you know, cancer specialists who were all pointing us in the direction of not just a vegan diet, but a whole foods plant-based diet with lots of iron rich and vitamin C rich and calcium rich foods involved. And so it's really funny because he was diagnosed with cancer and I had been anemic for the past 4 or 5 years. And we decided to make the shift together. We were living together. I became a caregiver at that time. And so it was really a struggle at first, learning how to cook totally vegan, learning, you know, how to even cook with vegetables. I was you know, in that cycle that seemed so normal at the time of, you know, having meat in the kitchen and having this bloody bacteria filled mess that you have to deal with when you're cooking, which now when I think about it is, you know, the amount of disgust I felt dealing with my food before I cooked it should have been a sign that like probably shouldn't be eating that. But it really didn't click for me until we got that diagnosis. And one thing I noticed when I started cooking vegan right away was just like, oh my gosh, there's no blood in my kitchen. This is amazing. And then slowly began to realize the health benefits when it actually resulted in his tumor growth slowing down. It actually resulted in my first blood test that I did after going vegan. My anemia was gone. My iron levels were perfect. All of my blood levels were perfect.
Yay, love that.
Which was very exciting. And my partner, unfortunately, did pass away, but instead of having that 3 to 6 months, it was about almost 2 years after mm-hmm. the initial diagnosis, which was 2 years of love and growth and spiritual expression that we got to share, which I cherish very, very deeply. And so truly, I believe that a plant-based diet, if you are seeing yourself in a health crisis, for example, my father also had really severe type 2 diabetes, and it was getting to the point where it was, you know, a question of, are my organs going to shut down? Is this something that is going to, and his father passed away from complications from diabetes when he was pretty young. And so this was something that was also really scaring my father. And he's actually been vegan now for 4 months. And since he went vegan, he stopped taking insulin and he checks it every day and his levels have been normal. And this is like so inspiring to me to see plant-based diet can reduce tumor growth, it can reverse anemia, and it can reverse diabetes just in my, you know, personal experience. That's what I've seen and heard, you know, now can cure ovarian cancer as well and all of these other, you know, maladies. I think that one thing we kind of forget as a society is that food really is medicine. You know, the famous quote, let food be thy medicine, I think that was Hippocrates, is one of the most underlooked values of, you know, countless evolution of humanity, where it was, you know, I was in Kenya and had a pretty bad cold one time and wasn't sure what it was afraid it might be malaria. And I had some friends come over and they brought me the bark of a neem tree and some baby leaves from the tree and boiled it into this terribly bitter, bitter, bitter dark tea that when I drank it, literally within an hour, was feeling restored 100%. And so this is like, as I've been on my vegan journey, I've also been getting really into, you know, plant-based healing, holistic medicine, and also, you know, traditional medicines as well, and seeing that they can really be effective. And a plant-based outlook on healing, I think, is something that even if it's not your primary or your only avenue, it's something that everyone should look into and consider.
I'm taking a lot of notes as you talk, so I don't forget things I want to talk about. Okay. The FDA is not happy when we talk about food being medicine, right? Because we're not allowed to label food as medicine. But yes, food nurtures us and gives us the strength and the ability to take in toxins and get rid of them. Or heal ourselves quickly. And I want to give you my condolences. I'm sorry that your partner didn't live longer. I'm sure he was a wonderful person, but no one gets out of this world alive. My father used to like to say that.
Isn't that the only guarantee? You come to this world, the only guarantee is you're going to leave it.
And a vegan diet, a plant-based diet, no matter how healthy it is, isn't going to keep us from dying. Okay. So that's a given.
No,
but we do know that eating a whole food, plant-based, vegan diet, we have to add all of those words together so that it's clear what the message is.
Agreed.
Reduces risk. It's all about probability and risk. So reduces risk of chronic disease. And if you do get something, even like the dreaded coronavirus, your symptoms should be minimal, but nothing is guaranteed.
Absolutely.
but there are so many benefits to a whole food, minimally processed, plant-based vegan diet. that we want to do it because it's not just good for our health. It's not just good for our personal health, our family's health, our friends and our colleagues, but it's good for the planet's health and it's kind.
Mm-hmm. It's compassion.
It's compassionate.
It never felt like a sacrifice to me. It's no. Really never felt like I'm missing anything. You know, I grew up in this culture where we would barbecue all the time and it was very, you know, standard to eat like burgers and hot dogs and all these things. And if you want that, you know, culturally familiar food, this is the best time in the world to be vegan that has ever been, because you can get any product you want in a vegan version. Vegan cheese is actually delicious now. When I first went vegan, that was not the case. It was not good. So thank you to the food tech scientists. Thank you so much for all that you've done refining vegan cheese. But in general, I think you're right that it is the whole foods plant-based diet. And by that, we mean not eating the processed vegan meats and cheeses, but really focusing on getting all of your vegetables and all your fruits and legumes and grains and cooking those without, you know, high amounts of added sugar or any kind of preservatives and things like that.
You mentioned being healed by the neem tree.
Yes, the neem tree.
And there was a time when, I think in the United States government, they were trying to patent the neem and weren't able to. There was a big fight against it.
That's good.
Right? Because it's been used for all of our known history, probably.
Exactly. Indians in Ayurveda have been using neem for thousands of years to cure many different maladies. And, you know, as far as agricultural practices, neem oil has been used as well to work as a natural and organic insecticide. Where insects don't like landing on your plants if they have neem on it. So that's what I use instead of any kind of chemical-based pesticides. So would recommend trying that to any green thumbs who are listening as well. And yeah, I think that's really funny. I had no idea that they tried to patent neem.
There's a lot of nasty things out there. I'm a fan of technology and it sounds like you are too. And we'll talk about that in a bit, but we also have to be careful about technology because there's a dark side and there's a good side. It can do us good, but it can also do us harm. We have to be really careful about that. You got a degree in bioengineering.
I did, from Washington State University. Go Cougars.
Right. Go Sunny.
Oh, thank you.
When I went to college, bioengineering really didn't exist. I got a master's in chemical engineering and I was thinking about combining it with biology and doing something. I was interested in the environment. Didn't happen. And I enjoyed reading your story about the choices you made after getting your degree. My choices are not exactly similar, but I did work for DuPont for a year and a half out of college and I couldn't stay there.
Yeah.
I knew what they were doing. And there was a whole thing about the culture that was kind of in between the lines. And I can't believe I even recognized it back then, but I did get out. But I still worked in the semiconductor industry for a long time.
Oh, okay.
They weren't, from an environmental standpoint, there are problems with it.
Yeah.
But somehow I justified and felt better there until I moved to promoting healthy plant-based foods and working with nonprofits.
I love
it. But talk about your choice to go into bioengineering and then your choice not to go to the corporate world.
Yeah, absolutely. So I decided to get a degree in bioengineering because I knew I wanted to be on the cutting edge of technological innovation. And I was really inspired by the ability to biohack. And I know that the term biohacking might have a different connotation to everybody, but these glasses that you and I are both wearing, this is biohacking, you know, enabling us to see better any kind of medication that people are taking. That's a form of biohacking. And, you know, things like prosthetics and things like physical augmentation, even plastic surgery, I consider all of this under biohacking. But as well, innovation in technology, where I was really interested in things like prosthetics at the time that I decided to get my degree. And I ended up specializing in bioinstrumentation, which is interfacing the body with technology. And my first job in this field, I actually worked for the U.S. Army Research Office. And of course, I was very excited to get this first job, you know, feeling like as this research assistant, I would, you know, gain all of this necessary experience in my field. And at the beginning, thought that I would continue down this kind of corporate slash lab research path for a long time. However, in this first job that I got, it was, my job was actually data analysis, where I'm a coder. So I'm, you know, in MATLAB running analysis on this data we're collecting on a project that is heavily involved in animal testing. And this was when I was vegan already, as far as my diet choices. And I will say that I wasn't a full true vegan as everyone defines vegan, where I still had my leather bag that I wore because I bought it 3-4 years ago. And I was like, I'm not putting this down. I paid too much for it. But entering into this job was the first time I was really exposed to what animal testing is like, what it looks like in technology, where the project I was working on was capturing kangaroo rats, which are these very cute little rats that live in northern Nevada. And they're of interest to the US Army because a kangaroo rat lives in the desert. It can jump once, and its legs are literal springs, so that the energy from one hop keeps it jumping infinitely until it stops. Whoa. Meaning they don't have to exert any more energy. They don't have to actually move their muscles. It's just a spring. They just keep bouncing and they keep going and moving. And so they captured hundreds of these kangaroo rats from the wild, did these surgeries on all the rats where they inserted crystals called sonometric crystals into the rats' legs, and then made them do exhausting experiments for 8 months to measure the muscle dynamics in their legs. And that's the data I was measuring, was how is the distance between these crystals you've surgically implanted changing, and what does that tell us about the musculoskeletal components of these kangaroo rats, and how can we turn that into a robot that acts exactly like the rat does? And, you know, it was all fine when I was working behind the screen and when I was doing the coding and I was doing the analysis, but you know, I would go to the lab once a week or, you know, however often, and see the experiments that they're running and learned about the end goal of the project, which was when the rats are cycled through the experiments and they have their 8 weeks of testing done, they do a final experiment without any sedation where they cut the rat's muscle fibers while it's alive, while it's awake, fiber by fiber to measure the tension in the rat's legs until they cut all the muscles across what would be, what would be the quadriceps. And then after that, they euthanize the rats. And so all of this suffering and all of this pain and all of this energy and money and resources and time to ultimately develop robots that are going to be used by the Army to do God knows what. And so for me, while I got a lot of amazing experience in this job, a lot of that was experience in knowing myself and realizing that above everything, I have to do work that I'm ethically aligned with. Like there was a very kind of clear reason for going into bioengineering, which was partially to, you know, create the technology that's going to better the world, and also because it's a financially stable employment route. And I quickly realized that I couldn't do something, no matter how much you pay me, that makes me feel like I'm directly contributing to this suffering. So it was very conscious decision for me to move away from that field, especially move away from that job initially. And I feel like bioengineering will always have a place in my heart, but right now I'm really interested in the potential for mushrooms as far as everything goes: mushrooms for food, mushrooms for medicine, mushrooms for eating plastic. There's, you know, been discoveries in bioengineering marvels that have develop new mushrooms that can actually eat plastic waste and create composite materials and you know, actually digested into something degradable, which is really exciting. And so the direction that I see myself as an engineer going into in the future is very different from the direction I came from. However, I feel myself working as an architect and engineer of networks and systems now when it comes to blockchain. And that has been really rewarding and really exciting.
I'm just wondering how someone could come up with a test as you described on those poor kangaroo rats.
Wasn't me.
yes, clearly, but you just have to wonder how much is really for science and how much is somebody who's not well, who has been given a lot of authority and power.
Yeah, exactly. And I can give you all kinds of rationalizations to where they need to make these muscle dynamics charts so that they can, you know, calculate and predict future movements of these animals, but it doesn't.
No.
You know, at the end of the day, I don't think that it excuses or justifies any of that work. And that was really the first time for me where I felt strongly into my core that I cannot support any kind of animal testing. I cannot support any kind of animal byproducts. And I think even like as I'm in this job position, as I was leaving it actually, was when I got rid of all my leather bags and got rid of my Swiss shoes. And it was like, okay, like I'm done. I don't want to be complicit in any part of animal testing because I've seen firsthand, I've looked into these kangaroo rats' eyes. I've sat with them in the room as they're forced to run on these treadmills indefinitely and do all of these experiences and these experiments while they're in pain and while they're clearly, you know, just absolutely traumatized. And that I know, and it seems like they know that the end of this is not going to be good for them. And it was really hard. And you know, one interesting kind of thing about veganism is 80% of vegans are women.
Yes.
And 80% or something like that of engineers are not women, they're men. But we see in, especially in bioengineering, that was, you know, that statistic held up where it was 20-25% of the class would be women, the rest would be men. And I think that there's definitely a compassion component to veganism that everyone is capable of, obviously. There's plenty of vegans of any gender expression in the world. However, I think we're seeing it more readily adopted by women just because it's kind of societally encouraged or societally accepted to be compassionate and to express and outwardly embrace, you know, this kindness and this compassion. But that's something that I want to also encourage everyone to know, that you can embrace this compassion for animals and for other living creatures on this earth, no matter what, you know, societal norms and gender norms tell you. It doesn't have to be, and I don't want it to be just a women's movement, even though right now it clearly is.
I decided to become an engineer out of high school for a number of reasons. My dad had been a mechanical engineer, but I also felt it was an obligation as a woman because there were lots of paths I could go in. I could have been gone into fine art and into performing arts. And I did it as I just felt it was my obligation as a woman to raise the statistic or the,
it's so
the numbers
funny.
A tiny bit.
I felt like I had to, you know, had to push the envelope a little bit, or I wanted to have more diverse perspectives in the room. Because when it comes to any kind of, you know, authority or any kind of professional body, when you look at who's in power and who's in control, that's really the direction the whole industry is going to go in. And if the entire bioengineering industry is mostly controlled by men, you're going to see it heading in a very different direction than the field would go in if it was mostly led by women. And so I think that's reflected in the kinds of experiments and the kinds of lab research and the kinds of, you know, product, even products on the market that we see.
And also vegan products. There's a number of us talking about this right now because we see a lot of tech companies making plant foods that are not necessarily healthy and not entirely plant-based. They're like synthetic-based. They're like just not sourced from animals. And these companies are getting huge amounts of investment. And the people that are running it are mostly white men.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And there's a number of us that are rumbling underground saying, what's happening with our movement? What's happening with our plant-based movement?
Well, absolutely. And one of the, you know, inspirations to start the Vegan Africa Fund is, first of all, there was no Vegan Africa Fund before I started it. But I was looking at what kinds of ventures in Africa were being funded. And first of all, there is a huge funding gap where Africa in 2021 received $4.3 billion in startup funding compared to a global $600 billion, which means Africa gets less than 1% of startup capital. Obviously a huge disparity considering Africa is 17% of the global population. But when I looked into which companies were getting funded in the plant-based sector, it was mostly South African countries, and the biggest names that are getting funded are led by white men. And, you know, I've met them. They're very, you know, very, very nice. They're very much trying to get people to eat less meat, but it's still kind of represented this very dark mirror where one very, you know, disturbing statistic is that 97% of the world's wealth is actually controlled by white and Asian men. And when it comes to venture capital, 87 to 90% of founders who are backed by venture capital are white. And so this is a very, when you look at how this funding is being deployed and who's, you know, controlling the wealth, it feels like the same cycles are being perpetuated, where there's lots of talk about equity and equality and, you know, uplifting founders of color and investing in, you know, diverse perspectives. And then when you look at the numbers, even 2021, where there's been all this talk for the whole year, the numbers are still coming up the same, where Africa actually has less percent of the global startup funding than it did in 2020. And again, there's a surprising number of founders who are white receiving this venture capital. And so when people are looking at African numbers for investment, I just want them to kind of be reminded of that what's lacking in what we're working to implement and solve at the Vegan Africa Fund is investing in Black founders and women founders. So we have an organizational mandate that at least 60% of the businesses we invest in, or a good majority, are led by women. And, you know, to really offset the gender imbalance, maybe it should be 100%, but we're not going that far right now, because I also see, you know, there's plenty of male founders out there who are really leading in the vegan product production space. But we also really want to invest in community-driven ventures that are very much, you know, tied back to the plant-based legacy of eating in Africa and able to connect culturally with their customer base as far as the food products that they're producing. And so we're seeing, I think, a very slow shift towards equity when it comes to investing, and I'm really trying to ramp that up as much as possible, because the time is now. And I think the people with some of the best climate solutions, the people with some of the best plant-based product solutions, are these underserved founders who lack access to capital to scale their ventures, but absolutely have incredible business plans, incredible missions, incredible customers and community, and ultimately need support early on so that they can expand and become globally competitive. And when we're investing in Africa, a big reason why is to help offset some of these trade imbalances, where when we think of Africa and all the raw materials and resources we have, it's amazing. You know, every single smartphone, every car battery, every computer, the precious metals to build those probably came from Africa. And yet so many products are shipped out of Africa in the form of raw materials to places like China or India or Europe or the States. and the real value is added to these products and materials outside of Africa, which basically results in them getting very low margins and returns on these products they're selling. And it's really hard to build wealth in that way. And so we're working to help startups, working to help small businesses, working to help eco entrepreneurs to actually acquire machinery and infrastructure and capital that allows them to produce their products at scale and become a global leader in sustainability and veganism. And that's something that I see as the future for Africa, is truly that the Vegan Africa Fund helps it emerge as a leader in veganism. And that when all of this wealth is created from the vegan product movement in the next decade, that African founders can be shareholders of this new vegan economy in a very powerful and strong way.
Woo!
And now I'll take a breath.
Wow. Okay. So backing up just a little bit before we continue. First, I wanted to say you are a very brave person, very brave, very courageous. And I applaud you just for that. To be in a job like you were, I'm sure making a very fine salary and doing things that for the most part were interesting to you, it's difficult to leave. And there are many people who don't leave, especially people who have families and they want to put their children through college and they have mortgages and expenses. And they're like, okay, which do I weigh? You know, my family and my needs or this little ethical problem I'm participating in. Very, very hard choice. So I applaud you for that.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you before, is Sattva your real name or is that a name you chose?
So it is my decolonized name and it is a name I chose.
Okay. Beautiful. Because when we're talking about vegans, it's a very appropriate name. It deals with purity and virtue and wholesomeness and, and it's just a lovely name. So I was just curious about that. And Sunny as well. Did you choose that name too?
It is. Yeah. I chose my name. It was a nickname for a long time and it felt very fitting. So I went to the court and said, I'm going to decolonize my name. It had been a long lifetime of, you know, realizing that the name that I'd been given wasn't necessarily one that I felt fully aligned with. And one amazing thing about being an American is everyone has the right to change their name through legal court proceedings.
Yeah, we're going off in a different direction here, and I have a list of things I want to get back to. But when you had mentioned my name, Karen, C-A-R-Y-N, and wondering how to pronounce it, I didn't know until I was older, because my parents, of course, thought they were original, and they were not. There are many Karen, C-A-R-Y-N, and we have nothing to do with those K-A-R-E-Ns that have been getting slammed in the last decade.
Oh, I know.
we're different. But Whoopi Goldberg's original name was C-A-R-Y-N.
Oh, that's awesome.
And a lot of people don't know that, but I feel like connection there.
That's so cool.
But it's interesting how simple things like changing a name can have such a profound impact on our feeling of our own self-worth and our foundation.
Yeah, one reason why I decided to change my name was actually a friend told me this. They said, the most beautiful sound to your own ears should be the sound of your own name. And if it's not, you should consider changing it. And that was a really profound moment for me. And yeah, Sunny Sattva is the most beautiful sound in my ears.
I love that. Now, and just a moment back to white men. There are some wonderful white men out there. I happen to have one as a partner. He's vegan. Aww. He's awesome. He's creative. He's kind and considerate and compassionate and just fabulous. And I'm very lucky to have met him. And there are many white men who are entrepreneurs and running interesting companies and have very good missions and are motivated by very, very kind and compassionate objectives. But even them only know their own experience. They don't know the experience in this lifetime. We don't want to go there. of living in a different gendered body or living in a different color skin. And you have to work very hard to be able to relate to people that don't look like you. So that's my little thing about white men. We'll leave that where it is. And then now let's talk more about the Vegan African Fund. You gave a very nice introduction, and we've taken a lot from Africa. We, as the Western society, the Western developed, and I put those in air quotes when I say developed, we've taken a lot. We've taken raw materials. We've taken agricultural products. We've taken people. we've destroyed cultures and history.
Yeah.
And we've taken land.
Absolutely.
It's just profound. And now when we're divvying out money to help people, we're not giving very much back.
And well, one thing that, you know, inspired me to start a fund instead of a nonprofit initiative is when I'm speaking to founders and when I'm speaking to leaders in these communities across Africa, one continual kind of complaint that I was hearing is Africa receives way too much money from NGOs, way too much money that's given as, you know, nonprofit funding. It's given to people basically, you know, as handouts in the form of food or assistance of whatever kind, but it's not sustainable in that it's not regenerating at all. It's like, you know, that saying, I'm going to veganize it, you know, you can give a man a loaf of bread and he'll eat for a day, but you can teach a man to bake a loaf of bread and he'll eat for a lifetime. So if you're investing food for a day, that doesn't get people very far if you're, you know, donating rather. And one thing I saw is Africa is really over-donated and severely under-invested, where there are countless opportunities for African founders to grow wealth in their communities just based on the raw materials and based on what they have. But again, what's really lacking is in most of Africa, there was never an industrial revolution, meaning there's limited machinery, there's limited processing, there's, you know, in every single country, there's different levels where there's very industrial, you know, high-tech cities, and then the villages and the farms are very much living with the earth. And so there's very much every layer of development, I believe, is found within most of these African countries. And so when we're looking at investing, the things we need to recognize is exactly what you said, that the West has taken so much from Africa over the past six centuries and beyond. There's this set of sustainable development goals that the world says it wants to meet. You know, however many countries, 100 countries have signed on to this United Nations pledge to help meet these sustainable development goals. But what is needed to meet them is financing. The UN estimates that between $5 and $7 trillion a year needs to go towards investing in sustainable practices to meet these goals. And of that, $300 to $500 billion every single year additionally needs to be invested into Africa to meet these goals, which is a massive sum of money. And I think that's really reflective of the real world value of all of the bodies, all of the raw materials, all the people and communities and lives that were taken from Africa over centuries and centuries. Now it's all culminated. And in order to, you know, reverse those trends of, you know, just absolute in what we see as environmental destruction and this continuation of unsustainable Western practices that you see proliferating in Africa, in order to reverse that, it is going to take a huge movement, and I'm excited to do whatever part I can to help that movement succeed.
In talking about NGOs, nonprofit organizations versus for-profit organizations, I had spoken with Timothy Wise. Are you familiar with him? I've spoken with him a few times on this program.
Okay.
Right now, he's a senior advisor at Institute of Agriculture and Trade Policy, the IATP. I got to know him through Francis Moore LePay's organization, the Small Planet Fund. He does a lot of reporting and he visits countries, and he wrote a book called Eating Tomorrow, which I love the title because you can take it so many ways. Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. And he's also written a number of articles. The thing we talked about most recently was the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA, which is funded by the Bill Gates Foundation.
Cool.
And he says this organization, this funding and this plan has failed to achieve its goals. And they're not talking about how they failed to achieve their goals. And so I bring it up because it's an NGO, it's a nonprofit fund that is funding and giving a lot of money, but who's directing it and who's making the decisions? It's not the people in the community making the decision and the choice for their own country and for their own future. They'll take the money and the governments will take the money. And sometimes they won't even funnel it to the right places. And it's really, really unfortunate. We need you.
That's interesting. Yes. No, I haven't heard about this at all, but I'll look into it now.
There's so much. There's just so much out there. It's overwhelming, but yeah.
Overwhelming.
But this is a good resource. So here we are. We don't have very much time left. I just want briefly, can you tell us about the blockchain?
Yeah, absolutely.
What is it and why is it important?
So at a basic level, blockchain is just a techie word for decentralized ledger, which is a ledger that records every single transaction that's happened on a public interface where anyone can see, for example, all the history of Bitcoin transactions. You can see every single transaction that's happened, and no one can ever go back in the past and change it. So blockchain is incredibly powerful because it can end things like corruption. It can end things like money laundering because you can track every single transaction, what wallet it's gone to, where it's going. And it gives a layer of accountability to businesses that before blockchain, you know, people were going back in the books and maybe fudging numbers or something, or maybe changing transaction lines. You can't do that with blockchain. It's append only if you're a coder, which means you can only add to it, can never take away. And we've launched the VAF crypto, which is on the Phantom blockchain, one of the most eco-friendly blockchains in the world. There's no mining associated with it like Bitcoin and Ethereum, which means there's no mining fees and there's no energy that's diverted to mining these coins. And we've launched VAF on the blockchain to enable all of our supporters globally to invest in the vegan future of Africa. So we are currently raising our first round of the Vegan Africa Fund, which closes at the end of January. And our mission is for the VAF blockchain to enable cooperation of vegan businesses all across Africa, where right now we've invested in Vegan Basket on the Kenya coast, where you can go and spend VAF, which is a cryptocurrency that represents holding a stake in the Vegan Africa Fund, supporting the vegan future of Africa, and it's something that allows you to buy and purchase sustainably produced vegan products in Africa. And the mission and the vision for VAF, which you can read about on our website, veganafricafund.com, is to enable a pan-African food trade system around vegan food products, to enable global investors who support the expansion of these vegan businesses to actually invest now, receive VAF, and once these businesses are ready to export their products, and these are things like vegan meat and dairy substitutes, vegan leather products, vegan eco-packaging materials, vegan packaged foods, exporting all of these around the world is actually one of our goals to help reverse a food trade deficit in Africa. And using the blockchain, using VAF, investors can both support the expansion of these products and later purchase them, you know, for their own consumption. And the way that I believe the, let's say, the saving the world will commence, or the way that we're going to solve climate change, solve world hunger, meet these sustainable development goals, I think it really is going to come from a greener, more eco-capitalism. And I believe that blockchain enables that, because one of the most frustrating things about capitalism is, of course, the corruption, is the bribery that goes on and the funds that go missing and all of these, you know, toxic parts of capitalism really have to do with there being so many closed doors that people can hide behind and do all these transfers in secret. And with the blockchain, it's very transparent. You can go on our website right now, go to the invest page and find our contract address for the VAF crypto. And that is an address that allows you to see every single transaction that's ever happened from every single wallet that's holding VAF. You can look at any wallet you want. And this is really a way of us achieving our goal, which is ultimately to, one, support the vegan future of Africa. Two, the Vegan Africa Fund has a mission of, by the year 2025, holding equity in vegan-owned and operated companies in half of the African nations, and ultimately to help support vegan food product producers getting their products across African borders and to the rest of the world. It's kind of insane to me that every single year, over $40 billion more worth of food is imported into Africa than what's exported. It's not sustainable, and it's really, I think, a factor of the means of production are lacking, where, like I said, when we're investing in the businesses we're investing in, I'm looking at business plans where I've seen over 300 small businesses, small and medium businesses that are vegan across Africa, many of them seeking funding. And everyone who's seeking funding is seeking machinery to help them go from making every single thing by hand, where right now they're making all of their vegan burgers, all their vegan sausages, vegan cheese, everything by hand, essentially, really shifting that towards scaling it for, you know, massive distribution. And that is a huge funding gap and a huge infrastructure gap. And there's a big technology gap in Africa that we have to fill, and it needs funding in order to be filled. And the blockchain, I believe, is one of the best ways to see this funding realized and see this vision realized. And so everyone who is excited about our mission and willing to join us, you can check us out on all your favorite social media platforms at the Vegan Africa Fund. So it's at Vegan Africa Fund on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, wherever you are. And ultimately, we've supported vegan efforts in 5 countries in 2021. And our goal is to just continue this momentum and continue this growth in 2022.
Okay, my mind is blown. Sunny Safa, you are awesome.
Oh, Karen, you are amazing. I'm awesome. So excited. Thank you so much for having me. It is all about food, people, the world, climate change, hunger, everything, all of the biggest problems we're facing. It comes back down to food.
It's all about food. And you mentioned that Africa's importing so much food, and I bet a lot of that isn't very healthy food either.
No, a lot of it is meat and dairy, meat from Brazil, the United States and Europe, and dairy from Europe, and as well, lots of processed oils and cereals. So not very healthy at all.
I could talk with you a lot longer, but we are at the end of the hour. So I just want to thank you so much for being you, for being Sunny Safa.
Thank you.
And I know you are going places.
Thank you, Karen. I am excited to be on this journey. I'm very grateful to you for giving us this opportunity to speak to your audience. And I hope we get to speak again soon. This was a lot of fun.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, Happy New Year. Take care. Be well.
Happy New Year. Bye.
Bye.
That's our show, everybody. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been another episode of It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.